You're listening to Fundraising Radio, a podcast about fundraising for early stage startups. The major rule that we follow here is no bullshit on this podcast. No music to relax you, no advertisements of our sponsors. We only talk about fundraising here and nothing else. So let's jump into the episode. And today's guest speaker, we have Sid Viswanathan, co-founder and president at Truepill, which recently closed their Series D round of $142 million. And this episode will mostly talk about this round, how they got to round D, why they keep on raising instead of going public, and so on and so forth. So Sid, let's kick it off by you giving us some background on yourself and on Truepill.
Hey, Constantine, thanks for having me on today. Well, I've been doing startups for a long time now. You're going to age me in this episode. I've been doing it for now 13 years or so. The last company I started was in 2009, and I sold that business to LinkedIn. And I spent about 4 years at LinkedIn in different product and engineering roles. And so my background is actually not in healthcare at all. But even before I got into startups, I was a mechanical engineer in college. I would say mechanical engineer turned software engineer. Once I got to the Bay Area, I started to realize that this was in 2008, 2009 timeframe, where there weren't as many hardware engineering jobs and mechanical engineering jobs specifically. So it was either software or nothing. And so couldn't go back to college at that point. My dad wasn't going to pay for another degree. So just quickly learned how to build some of the basics from a development standpoint and ended up starting my first company. And after selling to LinkedIn, I stayed for several years, and around 2014, 2015, made the decision to leave, to go back to the drawing board again. At that point, I didn't really know what I wanted to do next. All I knew was I wanted to start a company again. And along the way, I spent time exploring different areas and different spaces. And that's when I met Omar, my eventual co-founder in Truepill. And we formed the initial thesis of the company, which was, what would it look like to build pharmacy infrastructure? And Omar is a pharmacist by training. And so when you put a software engineer and a pharmacist in a room, I guess maybe that's how you get Truepill born. And we set out to build pharmacy infrastructure in 2016.
That's perfect. All right. So let's first talk about your experience with LinkedIn and then you hopping off of LinkedIn, which is quite interesting. So you spent there, you said 4 years. When was the moment when you were like, you know what, I'm done here, I'm going to go ahead and fund or create my own company? When was that moment? What triggered you?
I think as a founder, you always have that underlying itch. You just don't know when you kind of have to scratch it. And I had a good run at LinkedIn. It had several ups and downs trying to figure out where the company that I sold would live within the ecosystem. And finally, mm-hmm. we got to the right kind of final resting place for the asset. And that was about 3.5 years into my journey at the company. And it seemed like a good time to sort of end that chapter and move on to the next journey, which was eventually Truepill. But even before Truepill, it was about a year of banging your head up against the wall, thinking about their idea. I don't recommend this to other folks. And for others that are still thinking about what they might do, I recommend going back to the basics of finding a good problem. If you look mm-hmm. at everything from what you read online in terms of how to find the right startup idea, I think we got very fortunate and lucky that we stumbled into the right problem and we were also the right team. But sometimes looking for a problem isn't always the best way to go. It just worked out for us in our case.
100%. So let's not focus on finding the problem and instead focus on finding the co-founder. So you said that you just briefly mentioned that you ran into Omar somehow. Can you tell us how exactly you met your co-founder and how do you realize that, you know, that's the right co-founder for you? Was it just based on the skill set? Was it because you've known him for X amount of time, or what was, you know, what made you think that that's the right co-founder?
Yeah, believe it or not, this was a cold LinkedIn email that I sent to Omar back in sometime in 2015. And I was doing explorations around pharmacy that week. It was probably the space of the month or space of the week that I was researching. And mm-hmm. I looked for a startup founder and pharmacist, and Omar's name was the first one that came up. And I think his headline at the time was startup enthusiast and pharmacist. And so he was the top list on LinkedIn. He happened to be in the Bay Area. I think he was traveling at the UK at the time. And I just sent over some questions and he responded back right away. And after several weeks, we kept going back and forth on LinkedIn with more and more questions and thoughts. And finally, we said, well, sounds like you want to do something in this space. Why don't we get together? And we met up in person. And 2, 3, 4, 5 months in, we were still spending time talking about the space and trying to understand what the starting or entry point might be. And so we actually met for the first time before we started Truepill. And I think I would recommend knowing your co-founder for as a long a time as possible or going into a relationship. But in our case, maybe I hit the lottery and we found each other at the right time and right moments in our career to start the company. And it's worked out well for now. We've been working together for 5 years.
Nice. That is a great story. And yeah, I mean, I've seen far too many startups that were started like that and then they fell apart just because the co-founders just weren't as lucky as you got. So do you have any advice to those founders who don't yet have a co-founder? Most likely they know that they just absolutely have to have a co-founder because going through this alone is just a little bit too hard. So any recommendations on looking for a co-founder and testing out if that's an actual good match or not?
I would say definitely think about aligning on some of the value side of things. Ultimately, mm-hmm. you're going to pick someone that's smart and hopefully complements you and has the right skill set for the founding team. But I can't understate how important those values are. And sometimes you can't sit there and ask that person, what are your values in life or your cultural values? That's not really how it works. It's more of a vibe. And I think for Omar and myself, we were at sort of the right or similar stages in our life. We were in our early 30s. Omar had a kid that was just born, it was 6 months old. And for us, we certainly, my wife and I wanted to have a family. So we were at similar life stages from a personality mm-hmm. standpoint. I think we gelled. And I think the advice I give is you don't need to find a best friend. A co-founder is not a best friend that you want to hang out with all the time. And we've had a great business and working relationship. And we don't have to see each other outside of work to socialize. And that's been our relationship. And it's worked really well for us. So my advice is definitely look at the value side of things, start to anticipate how you might address conflict because you never mm-hmm. can simulate conflict and you have to get a sense of, well, is your co-founder going to be level-headed and pragmatic and rational as you go through different disputes and different challenges through the business? And some of it is a calculated risk and a calculated guess. And in some cases it works out and sometimes it doesn't. So I would say cross off all the obvious things of finding the right complementary co-founder, but certainly look at the values and how you guys gel together. And a lot of it is chemistry and just a feeling and a vibe.
Mm-hmm. 100%. That's as good as it gets, honestly. There is no silver bullet for this one, unfortunately. So now let's move on and talk about the subject that doesn't have a silver bullet either, but it's at least more calculated. So let's talk about fundraising and specifically your post-YC seed round. So I forgot to mention in the beginning of the episode that Truepill actually did go through Y Combinator and afterwards they raised their seed round. So can you tell us a little bit more about that seed round and especially how did you manage to get into YC? What stage were you in while you were getting into the Y Combinator?
That's right. We were part of the summer 2017 program. And not unlike many other companies, we were a second time YC applicant. We weren't accepted the first time. Our traction wasn't really there. And we applied the mm-hmm. second time and got in. And really the main difference between the application was just more traction. I think YC is getting a lot better at, they can wait and see when you kind of follow through on what you say you're going to do on the first application, especially mm-hmm. when you're just getting started. And for us, we bootstrapped the company for about a year. For that first year, Omar was still working nights and weekends at CVS. I had left LinkedIn, so I was kind of full-time working on the startup, but I was like writing code that nobody was using and it wasn't really useful because we didn't have anything to build really. And so you're kind of just going through the motions of starting the company while waiting for your pharmacy board approval. And so once we got our pharmacy board approval, then we were in business and we started filling prescriptions and going through the model that we were setting out to do in the market. And we weren't actively thinking about fundraising, but we came to this moment of why don't we apply to YC? There was the summer session opened up again, or we were thinking about it in the winter. We applied and then we didn't get in. And then in the summer, we said, okay, well, we have more traction now. Why don't we just try again? And we got accepted that time and joined. And I think one of the best things about YC is it's really a forcing function to start thinking about fundraising or put that mm-hmm. on the forefront or accelerate that. And I don't think there are many companies that join YC with the mindset of we're not going to fundraise or we don't need to fundraise. And so for us, it was, well, how do we set ourselves to succeed going through the fundraising process? And about a month into YC, we raised money from Initialized Capital and Gary Tan, somebody who I'd known for many years, even prior to YC, was the first call I made after we got in to say, hey, Gary, we got into YC. What do we do now? And he said, why don't you come into my offices? And eventually made the first bet into the company, and we went on through YC to raise an additional $2.4 million in our seed round. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how it happened. And we went through the entire demo day process and wrapped up our fundraising pretty quickly thereafter.
Lovely. That's one of the major perks of YC. Usually every single company closes their seed round after graduating from YC in a few weeks, which is absolutely epic, and I love it. So looking back at that round, I've heard a few founders complain about, you know, oh, I wish I did that. Oh, I wish I took less investors in. Oh, I wish I increased the minimum check amount that we were accepting, and so on and so forth. So looking back at that post Y Combinator seed round of yours, do you think you've made any major mistakes that you wish you have changed now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think YC is great, as I mentioned, as a forcing function to get prepped up for fundraising. But I think one of the things that, maybe if I were to pick on one regret, is you don't really get the time to start thinking about, well, who do you want in your round? Who do you not want in your round? What's the right composition? What's the right dilution? Because you kind of go as quickly as possible to wrap it up. Mm-hmm. I think while we ended up on the positive side in terms of dilution, I believe it or not, if I saw certain folks on our cap table walk by me on the street, I might not even recognize them today. And that's unfortunate, because they invest and you never hear from them again. But on the flip side, I would say an investor that writes you a check and then disappears is probably better than a meddlesome investor. And so it's a little bit of a double-edged sword. But if I were to say one thing we would go back and do differently, is we didn't have the foresight or the thinking around doing a friends and family round, and especially something you can never go back and redo. I always recommend now to founders, just create a friends and family allocation. These are not necessarily folks that are trying to make money off your startup, but it's just folks that want to be well-wishers and supportive of the journey. And I always maybe thought of it as, well, I don't want to take their money if we're going to lose it. I don't feel good about it. But in retrospect, we ended up doing a friends and family allocation much later in the company's history, but I wish we'd done it from the beginning. And it's just a small part of the process. You can do it very easily now with convertible notes, and make sure that those that do want to support you, it's not an obligation that somebody has to invest because they're your friend or family. I wouldn't set it up that way. But for those that do want to participate and take a chance on you, I think that's what I would go back and do differently, is make sure we set aside some friends and family part of the fundraising versus folks that today I might not even recognize.
That's very interesting. That's the first time in my entire life that I hear this kind of advice. So let's drill down on that a little bit more. Friends and family round. That is very rare that someone raises friends and family round after the seed round. Why exactly did you decide to do that? Was it just, you know, you felt that Troopy was doing great, you kind of wanted to have more promoters of it or true supporters, and you were like, you know what, I'm pretty confident we're not going to lose money on this, so I'll open up a small round for my actual friends and family. Is that how it went, or was it mostly?
I think there was certainly a little bit of pressure relieved on. I don't think it's ever, we won't lose your money. We're still a venture company, so that's always a possibility. But I think after folks kept kind of chiming on, hey, why didn't you let me into the seed round? Or, hey, are you ever going to do a friends and family allocation? It's really more of a testament to just wanting to support you as a founder. They might not even know anything about the business. They might not care about the business, but they want to support you as a founder. And a lot of times that's genuine. And I think I see that all across Silicon Valley, of just wanting to support your founder friends and your friends that are going on this startup journey. And I think since we missed that boat in the early days, we got a chance to create a small allocation. I think it was at our Series B. And I think AngelList also now makes it really easy to set up a syndicate to do this with a vehicle, because you also don't want to necessarily have a ton of small checks spread out across your cap table. So now the actual vehicles and instrument to make this easy to do, it's really a no-brainer, whether you want to set up a separate SPV or go through an AngelList and pull together all your even 5, 10, 25K checks from people that want to support you. Maybe in the early days, that seems like a little bit burdensome to take a 5K check and manage it on the cap table. But today it's a lot easier to do that. And we got a chance to do that in a small way at our Series B.
Absolutely. AngelList is a genius invention. People who work there are geniuses. The things that they invent are absolutely great. So yes, if you want to do friends and family, definitely pull it together in a syndicate. It costs very little. I forgot the exact percentage, but you're not going to lose much money on AngelList by raising friends and family. And yes, it can be wonderful. Eventually, those people can be really useful mentors.
Without doubt, some of those folks still today, Constantine, are the, some of the loudest advocates for us, and champions of us. They become your biggest cheerleaders. So it's not just your board that's cheerleading. It's anyone that wrote a a 5K check or 25K mm-hmm. check, they become your loudest supporters. And I think that's really important. Sometimes individual angels and your friends and family that support you, they tend to play an outsized role in how much they support you relative to even a $1 million check from a VC, where you're one of many bets that they're making.
Absolutely. Having this one person, you know, continuously commenting on your updates and stuff like that, that is just, that feels nice. We, this podcast has a few.
Yeah, we all need some of that, right?
Exactly. And it just keeps you going, you know, you're like, oh, I've known this guy for 2 years. We've never met in person, but I've known him for 2 years. He has been supporting us for all this time. So yes, having such supporters is just amazing. So now let's jump from the friends and family round to your current Series D round. Those are pretty rare even for the Fundraising Radio podcast. So let's talk about how you got there. Can you tell us just briefly, brief overview of that round that you've just raised of $142 million?
Sure. We just raised a Series D of $142 million. And we've raised that in relatively short period of time. We're now are completing our fifth year of operating. And I think for us, our philosophy has always been around fundraising, trying to find as best you can, like the right inflection point in the business. And whenever we've looked at our different rounds of fundraising, it's never been about we have 12 months of runway left or 18 months of runway, we need to start thinking about fundraising. It's always been about, let's see to the best of our ability, at least to time the right inflection point. And for our Series A, it was about, we had proven some initial product market fit. Now we had to scale to 50 states and build more capacity across multiple facilities in the country. At our Series B, it was about expanding from one customer segment to now service payers or a broader customer segment and get deeper into healthcare and expand a business unit as well. We were just pharmacy when we started, and we expanded from pharmacy to telehealth. And by the time we got to our Series C, it was a continuation of that story, wanting to do more in the deeper healthcare market, working with more customer segments and continuing to expand the business footprint of not just telehealth, but now adding on our diagnostics business unit. And come full circle to our Series D, it was now, okay, we are seeing the repeatability. We are clearly in the growth side of the business. I think you're, by the time you get to the Series D, hopefully you're well past product market fit, at least for a revenue generating type of company. And you're on some spectrum of that growth story. And every company needs to get to different stages or types of repeatability. And for us, it's about trying to find out what are those levels of repeatability for our business at the Series D. And I think a VC once put it best for me. He said, at the stage, when you get to a Series D, you want to feel like you're putting a dollar into a vending machine and you're getting $2 out. And so how does every business start to operate that way at the Series D? Well, every business is very different. Our business is very complex. So we need to understand what those motions and mechanics of repeatability look like for us.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about repeatability a little bit. That is a common thing for later stages. And usually when founders get to that stage, they get comfortable. There is a certain level of predictability. It's not as much of a startup anymore. And in that case, founders get sometimes creative with their fundraising and start getting debt financing, start working with banks, and so on and so forth. Have you started doing that yet, or do you just stick with pure VC money?
I think we've stayed pretty traditional in terms of equity capital, but certainly when you look at the fundamentals of our business, we spend a lot of money on inventory, whether that's diagnostics or pharmacy products. And So we have your normal operating lines of credit, which now are pretty common vehicles in managing your cash flow, especially when you're dealing with a high inventory cost in your business. And so we've certainly had credit lines and various vehicles of that sort. We've never raised debt, but our credit lines now, the rates on credit lines are quite effective that it can, you can put your money to work that way. And other than that, we've been fairly straightforward on our equity financing as an approach for capitalizing our company.
Mm-hmm. One last question that I forgot to ask you is actually about your inflection points, as you just covered up. So you said that you try to time your new rounds based on your, you know, new trajectories. I was struggling with that word for the company. And I think you mentioned in our pre-interview call that you have recently expanded into the diagnostics field. Do you raise money for that expansion specifically, or was it just, you know, part of one of the inflection points of the company?
Yeah, it was one of the main inflection points for the company that led us to raising. We actually raised twice during the pandemic, which was uncommon. We raised in the early part of the pandemic. And then in September of the pandemic year, we raised our Series C. So our B and C was actually quite closely timed. And I think that speaks to we were at the right time and place for building the type of company we were through the pandemic. We were talking about virtual healthcare. We were talking about infrastructure to move to telehealth for many years leading up to the pandemic. And then all of a sudden the pandemic hits and it's nothing you can ever plan for. And it's kind of your I told you so moment. This is what we've been talking about for a while. And you say, yeah, now the pandemic's here and everyone needs this type of infrastructure. And so that gave us some wind in our sails to go back to the market to raise and continue to grow on our ambition. But I think this is probably pretty common for many founders as you get to every year of operating and continue to maybe hit your goals and grow in your business, your ambitions get a little bigger and you start thinking about what else can we do? How else can we continue to grow? And it's hard once your revenue numbers get larger and bigger, compounded growth on a larger base gets harder and harder each year. So you need to continually start thinking about how to reinvent yourself each year and now start thinking about, well, what's to come to fuel the growth 2 years from now or 3 years from now? And in the first couple of years of your business, you're just trying to stay alive from quarter to quarter and keep growing. as you continue to grow, you still have a mind for, okay, what could go wrong in the business? How do you de-risk? That becomes your primary job function as a founder, is de-risking the business, but then trying to set yourself up for future growth, maybe 2-3 years out into the future.
Absolutely. And that's the fun part of the growth, and also not fun part of the growth, because the levels of anxiety still skyrocket as they were in the beginning. So let's talk about the beginning. Just one more question before we jump off to the very last question of today's episode. The majority of our listeners are early stage founders. So looking back at your, you know, experience of building your previous company that you eventually sold to LinkedIn, looking at the Truepill, do you have any advice for those people who are currently at their pre-seed stages / seed stages?
For sure. I think I'm a big believer in founder market fit. I think a lot of folks talk about product market fit and how to achieve product market fit. But for us, it was about having the right founding team to build this business. I still look back now, if I were to try to go back 5 years in time and handpick two better founders to build this, I'm sure you could find them, but what are the odds that you can put them in the same room together, in the same area, the same stage in their life, and the same ambition to want to build a very interesting company in what eventually became a broader industry trend around telehealth or virtual care? It's hard to do. So I'm a big believer in the serendipity of Silicon Valley and the way startups get started in general. But at the same time, you look at our founding skills, we had everything in our founding team to build everything from setting up pharmacies, running the pharmacy, to building all the technology assets and the infrastructure. And so my advice always is make sure it's a simple concept. You have all the skills on your founding team to build your first version of your product and hopefully first several versions of your product. Because as soon as you have a hole there, I can guarantee you that the capital efficiency of your startup will be very different. You'll see teams that maybe get started without tech talent on the team. And whereas their number one drainage of resources goes to paying for a development shop or a development team to build it. And in the early days, when you're trying to reach this promised product market fit and this elusive concept of product market fit, you want to make sure you can stretch your capital for as long as possible. And the best way to do that is have all the skills in your team to build your first versions of their product. And I think that's something that I would recommend everyone think about. Are you not only the right team to build this? Are there any gaps on the founding team? And it might be okay where you might need a third co-founder. It's not a bad thing to have a third co-founder that rounds out the skill set on the team, but certainly start thinking about where those gaps are on your founding team.
Perfect. That is a great advice. And yeah, having sizable teams that can cover most of the needs of a startup when it's building out its MVP, definitely a good call. On this optimistic, positive note, let's move on to the very last question of today's episode, which is a call to action. So Sid, once this episode is over, what do you want the listener to do right as soon as they hit stop or pause or jump on to the next episode? What do you want them to do?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, if you're looking to start a company, feel free to reach out. Always happy to share advice and feedback. And if you're not sure if you want to start a company yet, then I've always been an advocate for the best way to learn whether you want to start a company is come join another early stage startup or medium stage startup, whatever you want to call it. And if Truepill and healthcare is something that's interesting, definitely drop me a line. I'm on Twitter at Sid Viswanathan or on email sid@truepill.com. So we'd love to chat with you. And if healthcare is at all in your future in terms of wanting to maybe even start a company in healthcare, definitely reach out, because I'm invested in seeing healthcare tech and the broader ecosystem continue to grow.
Lovely. Perfect. On this note, my call to action is, as usually, extremely simple. Check out the description of this episode. I'll include Sin's LinkedIn. I'll include his email that he just said, and I already forgot it. For people who have memories as short as mine, it's going to be all in the description of this episode. And also, I'll include a few links to Truepill and, of course, shameless personal plug-in of our newly developed course on reaching out to investors. And as usually, have a good day.